From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Joss Whedon. He's got two other shows on the air right now, Angel, a spin-off of Buffy, and a new series called Firefly. The rap group Run-DMC is disbanding after the untimely death of DJ Jam Master Jay. We'll listen back to an interview with Daryl McDaniels, the co-founder of Run-DMC. Also, film critic John Powers reviews 8 Mile, starring rapper Eminem. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan praised today's unanimous vote by the Security Council approving a new resolution to disarm Iraq. Annan said the 15-0 vote sends a powerful signal. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
The UN Secretary General says the vote reflects a renewed commitment to prevent the spread of weapons of mass destruction and a universal wish to obtain that goal peacefully. He urged Iraq, for its own sake and for world order, to comply with a final opportunity to meet UN demands.
If Iraq's defiance continues, however, the Security Council must face its responsibilities.
Under the resolution, any violations by Iraq are to be reported to the Security Council immediately for action. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Negroponte, says that if the Security Council failed to take decisive action, member states could. Iraq now has 7 days to tell the United Nations whether it intends to comply. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, New York.
The two suspects in the Washington, D.C. area sniper murders appeared today in two separate Virginia courts. Lee Malvo was ordered held without bond today after a prosecutor said the 17-year-old's fingerprints were found on a rifle believed to have been used in the sniper attacks. The judge ordered Malvo to be held in adult detention after the prosecutor said the teenager attempted to escape from federal custody in Baltimore by wriggling through a ceiling utility space. He said Malvo was caught when he fell through the ceiling tiles into a nearby office. Malvo's companion, John Muhammad, made his first Virginia court appearance in a different county where the judge said he would appoint a public defender for him. The two suspects are accused of shooting 18 people and killing 13. San Francisco Congressman Nancy Pelosi appears poised to become the next leader of House Democrats, but she still faces a challenge from three-term Congressman Harold Ford Jr. of Memphis. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Pelosi is now minority whip, second in the Democratic leadership, and if she's elected leader next week, she'll become the first woman to head up either party in either chamber of Congress. Up till today, she was in a race with the Democratic caucus chairman, Martin Frost of Dallas. He said Pelosi is too liberal, but today he decided that she had the votes to win, and he pledged to support her. Harold Ford, who entered the race only this morning, said he was staying in. Ford tries to bridge the split within the Democratic caucus. He's a member of both the Congressional Black Caucus and the conservative Blue Dog Democrats. Richard Gephardt, the Democrats' current leader, said yesterday that he's stepping down. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 49 points to close at 8,537 in heavy trading. Declining issues led advances by 3-2. The Nasdaq lost 17 to close at 1,359. This is NPR News. The countdown began today for Monday morning's planned liftoff of Space Shuttle Endeavour. A crew of 6 Americans and a Russian cosmonaut will deliver a third section of the International Space Station's exterior frame. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE in Orlando.
Space shuttle crews usually train for a mission for a year or more. Two members of Endeavour's crew found out they were going to orbit just last August. Astronaut pilot Paul Lockhart was assigned to the crew after the original pilot, Gus Loria, injured himself at home. Lockhart flew on Endeavour's last mission just 5 months ago. Astronaut Don Pettit is in a similar situation, but he'll be staying in space much longer. Pettit was named a member of the latest long-term crew for the International Space Station. Don Thomas was supposed to move aboard the orbiting outpost, but NASA flight surgeons canceled those plans due to an undisclosed medical condition. Endeavour's crew will attach a $400 million segment of the space station's exterior framework. The new part will bring the truss to a length of almost 150 feet. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Another top official of the Securities and Exchange Commission has resigned. Commission Chairman Harvey Pitt issued a statement today saying that he was accepting the resignation of Chief Accountant Robert Herdman with regret. Pitt himself resigned on Tuesday in the midst of a controversy over his support for former FBI Chief William Webster as head of the new Accounting Oversight Board. After Webster was accepted on a party-line vote, commissioners learned that Pitt had failed to inform them that Webster was on the audit committee of a company that's being accused of fraud. Herdman, who was also involved in Webster's selection, said in a letter that he was stepping down in light of recent events. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Americans for Balanced Energy Choices, educating Americans on the issues of affordable electricity from coal and a cleaner environment. BalancedEnergy.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross.
You really have no idea what's going on, do you? Do you think it's coincidence you're being here? That boy was just the beginning.
Oh, why can't you people just leave me alone?
Because you are the Slayer. Into each generation, a Slayer is born. One girl in all the world, a chosen one, one born with
the strength and skill to hunt the vampires, to stop the spread of their evil blah, blah, blah. I've heard it, okay?
I really don't understand this attitude. You've accepted your duty. You've slain vampires before.
Yeah, and I've both been there and done that, and I'm moving on.
That's Sarah Michelle Gellar and Anthony Stewart Head from the very first episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a TV series that aired for 5 years on the WB and is now in its second season on another broadcast network, UPN. The show and the character were created by Joss Whedon, who's a very busy guy right now. He's got Buffy, its spin-off series Angel, still on the WB, and a new sci-fi show called Firefly, which is trying to build enough of an audience to succeed Friday nights on Fox. That's three shows on as many networks. I spoke with Whedon back in 2000, when he only had two shows on the air. But even then, he was working long hours and taking that work very seriously. Viewers put off by the silly Buffy the Vampire Slayer title, or by genre dramas in general, may still be unaware of what they're missing here. Buffy, for example, is full of metaphors about how loved ones can turn into monsters, how high school and college life is a particular type of hell, and how everyone, to some extent, is haunted by his or her demons. Characters grow, change, sometimes even die. When I talked to Whedon, I began by asking him what he had in mind when he crafted Buffy, his first crack at creating a weekly TV series.
The character of Buffy has grown a lot. I had always imagined I would take her on a pretty long journey. I didn't realize exactly how far we'd go. I didn't realize how far the actress could go when we first started. I knew that I wanted somebody who had to deal with the responsibility of this great weight, this burden of being a slayer, and that would help her to grow up as a person. And but I didn't know, you know, until I worked with Sarah for a while, you know, how far she could take it, how deep she could go in terms of the grief she could experience and the growth and the intelligence she would bring to it.
Did you know what you wanted to do in terms of this TV series, having come from places like Roseanne and doing movies and stuff, what you wanted out of a TV experience?
Well, what I wanted was to create a fantasy that was emotionally completely realistic. That's what really interests me about anything. I love genre. I love horror. I love, you know, action. I love musicals. I love any kind of genre, and Buffy sort of embraces them all. But ultimately, the thing that interests me the most is people and what they're going through. And that's why I loved Roseanne. That's why I wanted to work on it, because it was the only sitcom I felt was genuinely funny and also very real and very kind of dark. And that's what I wanted to bring to this.
There's one thing I'm really curious about in terms of your work, and that's if you see it, what you're doing every week in Buffy is writing different chapters of a novel, that by being in control, because you spend so much time reflecting on past history of the characters and past things that they've done, if you're careful about the sequence and if I'm correct in presuming that you allow ramifications to spread on down the line with what these characters do from week to week.
Well, I'm very, very much aware of it as being like a novel. The only equivalent to what you can do with a soap opera on TV to me is, you know, what Dickens was doing, and he happens to be my favorite novelist. The idea that you can get invested in a character for so long and see it go through so many permutations is fascinating to me. The shows that I've always loved the best, Hill Street Blues, Wise Guy, Twin Peaks, have always been shows that did have accumulative knowledge. One of the reasons why The X-Files started to leave me cold was that after 5 years, I just started yelling at Scully, "You're an idiot! It's a monster!" I couldn't take it anymore. I need people to grow. I need them to change. I need them to learn and explore and die and do all of the things that people do in real life. So we're very, very strict about making sure that things track, that they're presented in the right way. Because ultimately, and this is one of the things that I did find out after we had aired, the soap opera, the characters, the interaction between them is really what people respond to more than anything else. And although we came at it as a sort of monster of the week format, it was clear that the interaction was the thing that people were latching on to. So we were happy to sort of go with that and really play it up and really see where these characters were going to go. So now it is very much a continuing show, and we're always aware of that.
Let me ask you about how you get into position with the WB to turn a movie that at the time was 4 or 5 years old into a weekly series.
Well, Gail Berman went to work at Sandollar, and who had the rights to Buffy and very much wanted to turn it into a TV series. And when she approached me and I thought about, you know, the idea of telling horror stories about high school, since high school was pretty much one long horror story in my life, I thought that's actually a series that actually makes sense. That's interesting to me. So we developed it. And then the WB just right away, we pitched it to a couple of places. Fox turned us down. NBC, I don't even know why they asked us to come in. And then the WB got it right away. And my biggest fear was that they were going to say, make it stupider, make it lighter, make it fluffier, take away the edge. And in fact, they very much encouraged the dark side of it.
Now, is it unfair to ask someone who creates all of these characters if there's one that you either relate to more or have more fun writing when you drop into the various skins?
I have fun writing all. I love to write all of them. And part of that comes from the actors because their voices are so unique that the more I know them, the more. Like, I started to write Willow the way Allison spoke throughout the first season because she has such a particular cadence, and she and Nikki are both so witty. Of the characters that, you know, Spike is always going to be fun to write because he's always going to have the meanest opinion about anything. And therefore, you know, he's always got a good attitude. He's never just going to be there and be sincere and give exposition. He's always going to put a spin on something. As far as who I relate to, Xander was obviously, based on me, the sort of guy that all the girls want to be best friends with in high school and who's, you know, kind of a loser, but is more or less articulate and someone you can trust. That part wasn't like me, but the rest was. And I also sometimes identify with Giles, particularly when I'm working, and I feel like I'm supposed to be the grown-up in this insane group of children who are not paying attention to me when we have this mission, which in my case is to create this show. But I also went to English boarding school, and so knew a lot of Giles-y people, so he has a particular resonance for me.
When you build this show, even though it was set in high school, when it came time for them to graduate, you allowed them to graduate and then moved on to a different venue in terms of college. Number one, is that a reaction against, you know, the AARP card-carrying members of Beverly Hills 90210 and that sort of thing? And is it just the idea of the ongoing Dickensian story that you want to tell?
Yeah, I wanted to do the next thing. And that sometimes I thought, oh, I wish I could have kept them in high school a little bit longer, but it would have started to look silly. I did make one compromise. I had Oz repeat a grade because I wanted him to be there for Willow, and he had ostensibly already graduated. So that was my one cheesy maneuver. But I really felt like, yes, I want to keep them in high school, and that's probably the way they feel. Yes, I'm worried that college is going to be, you know, different and not as cool, and we won't be as popular as a show, and that's what they'd feel. The important thing is always to match whatever your characters are going through to whatever you're going through as a creator to what the audience is going through. When people worried about how are you ever going to give Buffy a boyfriend after Angel, how are they ever going to get over each other? Well, that's exactly what Buffy was worried about. That's exactly what Angel was worried about. It's, you know, it's taking the challenges, it's taking the fears that you have, and letting everybody go through them, because ultimately everybody always does.
And then you also get the metaphors as well. When she goes to college and has a roommate from hell, it pretty much is a roommate from hell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, there wasn't anybody I know who didn't say, oh, yeah, that was me. everybody thought that was based on them.
Whenever a program is not set in regular present-day normal stuff, I mean, everything from Star Trek to Bonanza, those shows are able, if they want to talk about certain issues at the time or to get away with some things that they can't otherwise. And I'm wondering if, well, the title of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the idea of monsters in some respects may make it a little harder for you to get respect from the Emmy community or something else. Does it also make it easier for you to tell certain stories or explore certain ideas?
Absolutely, it makes it easier. You know, Star Trek dealt with a lot of issues, you know, that other people weren't dealing with. As I said before, Buffy's not really an issue show. It's more emotional, but it allows us to get into some very hairy emotional places week to week in a way that you just couldn't with a normal show. You'd think your characters were schizophrenic. When you have the fantasy, you know, element of, oh, here's my evil twin, you can really examine another side of a character, and you can go to a very dark place if you want to. You can kill people off. You can bring them back. You can do all these things. You can put everybody through intense emotional paces, and that emotional realism is the core to the show. It's the only thing I'm really interested in. But when you have just a normal show, you can't really take them that to that many different places without it just seeming very fake. It's like, you know, soap operas, it's like, who's going to get kidnapped today? You can only do that so many times. But when your show is structured around a genre show, horror or fantasy or science fiction, then you have, you know, great license. What we don't have, which is what some science fiction shows have, is we can't just do a thing because it seems cool. Everything that we pitch, everything that we put out there, whether or not it works, is based on the idea of the audience has been through this. A normal girl goes through this. A normal guy deals with this. You know, it's issues of sexuality, popularity, jobs, whatever it is. It's got to be based in realism. We can't just say, you know, the warships come and they, you know, they transmogrify the blah, blah, blah. We can't do that. We can go to some pretty strange places. But at the start, we always have to be about, how does the audience relate to having done this themselves? That's why when we aired Innocence, when Buffy slept with Angel and his curse went into effect and he became evil again, I went on the internet and a girl typed in, this is unbelievable, this exact thing happened to me. And that's when I knew that we were doing the show right.
All right, let's listen to a clip from Innocence. This is the episode where Angel becomes evil.
You got a lot to learn about men, kiddo. Although I guess you proved that last night.
What are you saying?
Let's not make an issue out of it, okay? In fact, let's not talk about it at all. It happened.
I don't understand. Was it me? Was I not good?
You were great. Really, I thought you were a pro.
How can you say this to me?
Lighten up. It was a good time. It doesn't mean like we have to make a big deal.
It is a big deal.
It's what? Bells ringing, fireworks, a dulcet choir of pretty little birdies? Come on, Buffy. It's not like I've never been there before.
Don't touch me.
I should have known you wouldn't be able to handle it.
Angel!
Love you too. I'll call you.
That's David Boreanaz and Sarah Michelle Gellar in a scene from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. My guest, Joss Whedon, will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joss Whedon, the creator and co-executive producer of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and co-creator and co-executive producer of Angel. Death is a subject Whedon tackles often, but one of the things he does from time to time in Buffy and in Angel is to kill off very important characters, like he recently did with Buffy's mom and Willow's girlfriend, Tara. I asked him why he does that.
Well, I do it because I want to keep people afraid. I want to keep people in suspense. I want people to understand that everything is not perfectly safe. The problem with doing a horror show on television is that you know your main characters are coming back week to week, and you don't really care about, you know, somebody who just showed up for one episode. So, you know, every now and then you have to make the statement, no, nothing is safe. And that's a very effective way of doing that. If somebody objects, if somebody says, how could you kill that character? You have to bring that character back. You have to bring that character back. I know I've done the right thing. If they go, oh, they're dead, then I killed the wrong person because nobody cares. One of the things that people always shy away from is killing a sympathetic character. When I worked on Speed, there was a character who died, a lawyer that Alan Ruck played, and I took out the lawyer. He was a bad man. He was terrible. He was causing trouble, and he ended up dying. And I turned him into a likable sort of a doofy tourist guy. And they were like, well, now we can't kill him. And my opinion was, well, now you should, because now people will actually care when he dies.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody wants to kill a good guy. It makes them twitchy, particularly on a series. And we're very careful about it, because if there's somebody we know we're going to want for future episodes. But it does inflame emotions sometimes. But that is, in fact, what I'm trying to do.
When you talk about the flexibility and the versatility, that's also definitely true of the co-stars. And just about everybody who appears in the show. And I'm wondering, you came to Angel as the spinoff and to David Boreanaz's character, but you could have gone, it would seem, with a half dozen of them and spun off. How did you decide upon Angel?
Well, I have always been of the opinion that any one of these guys could sustain their own show. I think they're that good, I think they're that interesting, and I think they're that pretty. But Angel became the logical choice for a few reasons, and that was clear early on. One, he is, like Buffy, bigger than life. He, for the first couple of seasons anyway, was the only superhero on the show in the sense that Buffy was. You know, he had something more. Now, you know, Oz became a werewolf, Willow became a witch. Everybody sort of had something to make them more than they'd been, but at the time everyone else was a normal mortal, whereas Angel was kind of a bigger-than-life character, and if people responded to him like that, then he was going to have a kind of heat that would certainly make the network interested in making a show about him. I also knew that the romance between Buffy and Angel could go so far before it became incredibly tired, and we found interesting ways to shake that up. Obviously, the moment she slept with him, he turned evil, which, you know, as I was saying before in that episode, Innocence, was a huge benchmark for the show, but ultimately, you know, there were only so many variations we could play, and so it made sense to give him his own.
When you talk about the resonance of characters and keeping the history going, back in the episode of Doppelganger, I guess a couple of seasons ago now, there was a reference made to Willow, Allison Hannigan's character, as, at least in this other existence, having a bisexual sexuality, and that supposedly, based on the doppelganger rules, that might mean something on this real Buffy world. And I was wondering how the decision was reached to go that way.
Well, the arc between Willow and Tara has kind of a long and sort of tortured history. We had thought about the idea of someone exploring their sexuality expanding a little bit in college, because that's felt like one of the things that might happen in college. Since we tend to work inside metaphor for most of the show, you know, we talked about Willow and her, you know, being a witch, because it's a very strong female community. And it gives her a very physical relationship with someone that isn't necessarily sexual at first. And then when we decided to go that way, part of it was because Seth Green wanted to step out and do movies, and we knew that he was going to be out of the picture, and, you know, we had to do something with Willow, and it seemed like a good time for her to be exploring this. Then the question just became, how much do we play in metaphor, and how much do we play as, you know, her actually expanding her sexuality? And you're walking a very fine line there.
Now, when you do these major moves for your characters, the story meetings that you have with the other writer producers, how far ahead are you working? What's your Bible like, or whatever it's called?
Generally speaking, I come into a season with the arc for the season, the main villain, you know, the main sort of journeys for each of the characters. Where are they going to go? Some benchmarks, certain episodes, somewhere around episode 10, this has to happen. Somewhere around episode 15, this has to happen. We have to keep it flexible, because you come up with better ideas, or an actor falls out, or something happens. You know, the process of creating TV is entirely fluid. You always have to be ready to be thrown a curve. And in our case, every time we have, I think it's helped us out a great deal. But at the same time, you must have a bigger plan, both emotionally and structurally, because I make each show, each year on Buffy, work as a separate arc. I did that with the first season because I didn't know if we were ever going to air again, and I absolutely hate a show that ends in the middle before everything's over. It drives me insane if the story isn't finished. So with Prophecy Girl, the last episode of the first season, I finished the story, and if we had never aired another show, it would have still been a self-contained unit of 12 episodes that told a story. So that's how we designed every year.
Joss Whedon recorded in 2000. He's the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and co-creator of Angel. His new show is Firefly. A Buffy cast album of the musical episode Once More with Feeling has recently been released, and the third season of Buffy will be out on DVD in January. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Will this do a thing to change her? Am I leaving Dawn in danger? Is my slayer too far gone to care?
What if Buffy can't defeat it?
Beady eyes is right where needed, or we could just sit around and glare.
We'll see it through, it's what we're always here to do. So we will walk through the fire.
So one by one they turn from me. I guess my friends can't face the cold.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Audi and the all-new A4 Cabriolet, open up your world. Information at AudiUSA.com. And DK Publishing, publisher of Bill Wyman's Rolling with the Stones, the inside story of the rock and roll band told by a man who can tell it like it was. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear from Daryl McDaniels of the rap group Run DMC, and film critic John Powers reviews 8 Mile, starring rapper Marshall Mathers, a.k.a. Eminem. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The surviving members of the pioneering rap group Run DMC announced Wednesday they had decided to disband. Their move came in reaction to the untimely death last week of Jason Mizell, one of the group's founding members. He was Run DMC's DJ, known as Jam Master Jay, and he was shot and killed last week in his Queens recording studio. Mizell was 37. Run DMC was the first rap group to have its videos played on MTV and the first to make the cover of Rolling Stone. Mizell never appeared on Fresh Air, but the group's co-founder, Daryl McDaniels, spoke to Terry in 1997. She asked him about the reaction of his parents when he dropped out of college to pursue a music career.
They was mad. It was like, are you crazy? What are you doing? And, you know, even when they got a hint of me wanting to be a rapper as my career, as my job, you know, they was telling me stuff like, it's ridiculous. You better stay in school, and we're not paying all this money for you to go to St. John's for nothing. And as a matter of fact, when I went to record our first single, I didn't tell my parents because I knew they wouldn't have let me go. So they was outraged, you know.
How did they find out?
Well, I had to come tell them where I was at for the last 15 hours. You know, because I just left the house. It was a Sunday afternoon. I left the house about 1 o'clock, and I ain't come home in the morning until the next morning, like 5 a.m. in the morning.
Did you play them the record? Did they like it?
Yeah, I played them the record, and they didn't really like it till they heard it on the radio.
Now, was that It's Like That?
Yeah, that was It's Like That.
Great, let's hear it. This is Run DMC's first recording. That's Run DMC, their first recording. And my guest is Daryl McDaniels, who's the DMC in Run DMC. Now, when you started performing, it was the big gold chain era.
Right. Actually, we started that.
Yeah, there's some great pictures of you with giant big gold chains.
Yeah. Like when we were saying Russell was a big part of that, Jay was always dressing like that. The way Run DMC dressed, Jay always dressed like that. So when Russell seen Jay, he said, that's how you're going to dress. And that's when the gold chains came into play. Jay had a gold chain before he even thought of me in Run DMC. Jay wore chains like that when he was in high school.
Now, what would you think of those chains? I mean, especially looking back from the 90s at the early 80s with the big gold chains, they look so dated.
Yeah, right now it looks so funny. You know, I look at it and say, I can't believe we dress like that. I mean, what's the purpose of that? I mean, our parents didn't understand. What's the purpose of having a chain that big? You know what I'm saying?
I sure do.
And it's like, why? Why? You know, it looks so funny now, but back then it was like so cool.
What do you think it did for your image back then?
What it actually did showed that we had money, you know. It showed that we had the big gold chain and the fancy car and that we were truly the superstars of the neighborhood. You know, because if you got a big chain and the other guy don't, you must be doing something. And, you know, it also brought a bad image to us because people that didn't know Run DMC, before we had an album cover, I thought we was just drug dealers. Because most of the drug dealers was wearing chains like that and driving in big cars, even before the rappers made it big.
So were the chains solid gold?
Well, me and Run's was semi-solid, and Jay's was solid.
You were teenagers when you started performing. How did you handle fame when it first hit you and you were still in your teens?
Oh, man, fame hit us so quick. I mean, it's like now we got this thing that we say that certain periods in our career we can't remember, and we call it dazing. It was just like we was just in a daze. It was just like everything happened so quick, you know, the first record. Then we did the rap album, the first rap album to go gold because nobody thought rap was going to sell. Then right after that, we had the first video on MTV, and that was, like, really a precedent because the only black star they was actually playing on MTV was Michael Jackson. Then we got on in, and then when Rockbox, which was the video that got on MTV, went into heavy rotation, rustling everybody down at the record company and at Rush Management was all excited. Y'all on MTV, and me and Runner J was like, what is MTV? Why are you guys so happy about this? And then the big tour, the Fresh Fresh Tour, and we was going around selling out Madison Square Garden and all the big venues. It all happened so fast that, you know, it's like it smacked us upside the head. You know, the money, the fame, and fortune, it didn't go to our heads, but it smacked us upside our heads.
What was it like to suddenly have a lot of money?
Whoa, it was, man. It was, you know, me and Run always say, you know, when we was little, growing up and, you know, unless you was the star of the basketball team, the high school basketball team or the CYO basketball team or the neighborhood Hollis basketball team, none of the homeboys or the homegirls would give you any attention. And me and Run always said, all we want is one pair of Adidas, but our parents went and bought us Adidas because it was $40. It was like ridiculous to our parents, you know what I'm saying? They're middle class. So what's the point of, you know, we're going to buy you these $25 shoes, $20 shoes. If we could get them for $15, you're wearing those and you're going to be happy. And then when we became Run DMC, we could buy all the Adidas we wanted, all the Adidas suits we wanted. We could buy all the gold chains that we wanted. We could go buy the Cadillac that we wanted. And it was, like, just ridiculous. It was like God blessed us with everything that we wanted when we was, you know, growing up in elementary school. You know, you was at a point where you want to be like that guy who got every color pair of Adidas. And you want, you know, most, you know, you could tell the kids, a lot of the kids that was going to my school, they had jobs, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, we didn't have no jobs. The only job me and Run ever had was pushing shopping carts for the supermarket, giving out circulars. And that was like twice a week. But most of our friends, they had 9-to-5s and they was out there, you know, working and getting a lot of money. So every month, if something new came out, they could get it. So when we got money, it became we could get anything and everything. And we, as a matter of fact, we had stuff before it even came out because people started giving us stuff.
So you just started acquiring everything you could.
Yeah, exactly. Everything that we ever wanted, we was able to get.
Well, you know, you mentioned Adidas, and of course you have a very famous record called My Adidas. Before we hear it, why don't you say a little bit about coming up with this rap?
Well, it's real funny. Actually, Run's brother, Russell Simmons, came up with the idea. He, like, put it in the air. One day he said, y'all need to make a record about your Adidas and how y'all come from Hollis. And then the next day, you know, me and Run, we had the pen and pad out and we was writing this record. So we did the record even before we was approached by Adidas to, you know, for the promotional deal and stuff like that, for the endorsement. And the record came out, and then in 1986, you know, we was really the biggest thing going on in music. And an Adidas representative came to Madison Square Garden, and on that show, Adidas was the first record that we did. And before we did it, we said, whoever got on Adidas, take one shoe off and hold it up. And the whole Madison Square Garden held up the Adidas. And when the Adidas representative seen us, he was like, y'all guys got an endorsement. It's going to be big. You're going to be the first non-athletic group to get a major endorsement with an athletic company. And that was, like, really cool. But we made the record because we always just rapped about anything and everything. And we just gave a tribute to our Adidas saying, we're ready, sneakers for life, whatever. We don't care about Nike. We don't care about Bally. We don't care about nothing. Adidas are it forever.
My Adidas walk through concert doors and roam all over Coliseum floor. I slept on stage at Live Aid. All the people gave and the poor got paid. And out of speakers, I did speak. I wore my sneakers, but I'm not a sneak. My Adidas touched the sand of a foreign land with my forever, and you won't be had with more.
My Adidas by Run DMC. We're listening to a 1997 interview with co-founder Daryl McDaniels. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Daryl McDaniels, co-founder of the rap group Run DMC. Earlier this week, the group decided to disband following the death of one of its members, Jam Master Jay.
Now, how did it feel to see so many of your fans copying you? I mean, on the one hand, it can make you feel really, you know, proud and big and everything. On the other hand, it can really make you wonder about the independent thinking
of people. Actually, you know, my partner, Run, he was more excited about that. Like, wow, yo, look, we're the big, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, from a record-selling tip, it's, you know, it signified that, oh, wow, we're doing really great.
Right.
But then on another tip, you know, I was, like, kind of bugged. I liked it when rap was more... Everybody was more themselves, but we all could relate to the music. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It surprised me, and it made me feel good when Martin Lawrence, who's a comedian, Chris Rock, who's a comedian, you know, at the two times that I met them, they came up to me and said, D, because of Run DMC, I am what I am today. So that's good, because they didn't want to be a rapper like DMC and dress like me, but we inspired them to be what they wanted to be. They looked at us and said, I can do what I want to be. And it really hit me when Boyz II Men at the Grammys, Boyz II Men came up to me and said, we're doing this because of y'all. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, wow. You know, that's the type of effect mm-hmm. I want to have. I don't mm-hmm. want everybody trying to be Run DMC.
Was there ever any pressure on you from producers or record companies to harden your image, to make it more hardcore?
No, but we felt pressure on ourselves. In 1990, we made an album called Back From Hell. And on his Back From Hell album, it was like the first album we ever really used profanity. And it was like the first album we ever really came at everybody else in the industry. It was, you know, the first album where we kind of degraded women. You know, we didn't really talk bad like most records did, but we started talking. We started, you know, straying that way. And that was like one of our worst albums. So we learned a big lesson from that. I mean, that album was like a flop for Run DMC. It only sold maybe 250,000 copies. That was the year everybody was saying Run DMC was over. You know what I'm saying? Because we strayed from what we was really about. Even though we were still doing live shows, we made this album, which was trying to go with the flow of the times.
Mm-hmm.
When keeping it real is being real to yourself and staying who you are.
Now, I know that you're a Christian. Was there like a change in your life where you were born again?
Right around that time. I mean, you know, the records wasn't selling. Everybody was saying we was over. Run was smoking a lot of reefer. I was drinking a lot of beer. Things wasn't well within the group. You know, people was like saying, yo, Run DMC is over. You know, their time is over. And that was like really a down time. And, you know, with anybody, when it's time to, when you are down and out on your deathbed, I don't care who you are, you're going to scream out to God, you know, and he's going to answer, and it's up for you to answer his calling. And, you know, basically, it was nowhere else we could turn but to God. You know, God help us. You know, and we was like, yo, we're very thankful for everything that happened and this and that. And if only we could, you know, just get back to what we was all about. But we had to make that adjustment in our minds ourselves. You know what I'm saying? But it was like really a down time. I mean, the women, it was like the worst time for Run DMC of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know, all that stuff that you think, when I'm not going to go that way, I'm not going to happen to us. And it was like really a bad time for us.
And so when you were born again, how did that change your music and your lifestyle?
Well, it cleaned up our lives. We stopped smoking reefer, stopped drinking beer, stopped sleeping with every, you know, every groupie that you know, and stop running around with the drug dealers in the wrong crowd. And, you know, that's why we named the record Down with the King, because we said, wow, we're the only rap group that's been here for, you know, at the time we was out for 10 years. We're the only rap group that's been together for 10 years. Everybody else in the business broke up, and we realized that we had a marriage here. And we was like, yo, this is really like a marriage, because we're still here. Even though our popularity was down, people still gave us respect. So we was like, all right, we're going to dedicate one of these records on this album to God. And that record became the single, and that single became the name of the album.
Down with the King.
Down with the King.
Why don't we hear that?
Okay.
I'm taking the tours, I'm wrecking the land. I keep it hardcore because it's dope, man. These are the roughest, toughest words I ever wrote down. Not meant for a hole like a slow jam. Check it. Sucker MCs could never swing with D because of all the things that I bring with me. Only G.O.D. could be a king to me. And if the G.O.D. be in me, then a king I be. The microphone is granted when it's handed to me. I was planted on this planet and I plant the MC. The MC fiends only seem to agree that I rock of the world and the society. I rage on the stages with a tuna verse. I give praises from these stages to the universe. My voice is raw, my lyrics is law. I keep it hardcore like you never saw. You wanna be, you wanna be.
The group has been together, well, you've been recording since, what, 1982?
Yeah.
And started performing even before that.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily long, I mean, for any group, but particularly, I think, in the world of rap.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
How do you think you managed to stay together that long?
Wow, that's really a good question. The reason why we stayed together that long, because we never let the fortune and fame take away from the true art form of what rapping and emceeing means to us. Meaning that if we never made it as Run DMC, and Run, when he was going to college, he was studying mortuary science. I was studying business management, but then I would have had to change because I wanted to go into architecture, and Jay was studying business management. So even if we had wife and kids working 9-to-5s with families, on the weekends, on holidays, on days off, we're going to get together in the park, at Jay's birthday party, at our son's birthday party, and we're going to DJ and rap and scratch. So we never lost that desire of, we never let the rap become a thing as, we got to get money with this thing. We always like really doing it. We always like really doing a live show. And we always like, making fun lyrics or making lyrics that mean something. We never let the fortune take away from the art form or the meaning of, you know, the culture of hip-hop, what hip-hop really stands for.
A lot of rap groups brag about their neighborhood, often bragging about how tough it is.
Yeah.
What was your neighborhood like, Hollis, Queens?
Hollis, Queens was, it was a middle-class, hard-working neighborhood. It had a lot of educated people there, but you also had, you know, violence and drugs and prostitution and murder and rape and robbery right on the corner. You know, it's just good that we came from good families who made sure we went to school, didn't play hooky or run with the wrong crowd. So you had good and bad going on at the same time, which is true for every neighborhood, but some places have more poverty than other places, and people tend to let their surroundings suppress them. It was like we always, regardless of what going on, if we didn't have a dollar in our pocket or if we did have the dollar in our pocket, we were still happy. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Now, did you ever feel like you had to cover up the fact that your neighborhood was pretty middle class and that your parents wouldn't let you play hooky?
Nah, it was no way we could hide it because that was something the reporters made known to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they thought it was a big thing. All right, here you got this rap group making all this money, running around talking about their cars and, you know, how good they are. And, you know, they're selling a lot of records. And, you know, it was a thing where rap was supposed to be only done by, you know, people from the ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Because,
mm-hmm. you know, Grandmaster Flash and them, they came from the heart of the Bronx. And Afrika Bambaataa, they was from Bronx and Manhattan. They was from the ghetto. You know what I'm saying? Apartment buildings and broken glass everywhere. People's a subway. We came from Hollis, Queens, where you got separate houses, grass, backyards, cookout, Catholic school, and all this other stuff going on. But, you know, we wanted people to know you know, my mother and father, Jay's mother and father, runs by hardworking, educated people. But then you had the people that, you know, lived in the middle of the block, you know, they had to rob and steal for the next meal. But a lot of the press wanted to emphasize, I guess they wanted to let the world know that these guys are fronting. They might look tough and they might talk tough on their record, but they're middle class, Catholic school, nice guys.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. We're out of time. I wish we weren't, but we got to go.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Daryl McDaniels, co-founder of Run DMC, recorded in 1997. Earlier this week, the group decided to disband after the death of one of its members, Jam Master Jay. Coming up, a review of 8 Mile, the new film starring today's hottest rap artist, Eminem. This is Fresh Air. Rapper Eminem stars in the new movie 8 Mile. His latest album, The Eminem Show, is the top-selling album this year. Eminem is the latest in a long line of pop music stars who have appeared in movies, a list that stretches from Eddie Cantor to Frank Sinatra, Elvis, and the Beatles. Film critic John Powers says 8 Mile is much better than anyone expected.
Eminem is American culture's most electrifying figure. A hip-hop provocateur who's gained such mainstream acceptance that he recently stared out from the cover of the ultra-square New York Times magazine. Like Elvis, he's a crossover white whiz in a black musical form. And when it first came out that he was starring in a movie, I hoped Hollywood wouldn't tame his radical energy as it had the King's. Eminem obviously worried about this, too. He's a master at manipulating his persona, and he's tried to keep things real for his audience, especially his white teenage audience, which he famously calls Eric and Erica. The result is 8 Mile, a compelling semi-autobiographical creation myth that gives us Eminem as he'd like us to see him. The movie is set in 1995 Detroit, a collapsing city whose 8 Mile Road marks the borderline between the urban and the suburban, the black and the white. Rabbit, that's Eminem, hopes to cross that line. And when we first meet him, he's entered a face-to-face rap-off at a local club. He chokes, and the rest of the movie is about getting him back to the club so he can win next week's contest. He is, after all, Eminem. Along the way, 8 Mile shows us Rabbit's art being forged in the cauldron of daily life. He works as a metal worker and lives in a trailer with his mother, well played by Kim Basinger, a dim, selfish woman who's sleeping with someone he went to high school with. Along with his predominantly black homeboys, Rabbit spends his nights driving around aimlessly, engaging in meaningless fights, and meeting his muse, an aspiring model played by the revved-up young actress Brittany Murphy, who seems positively loony. Her eyes spin like the cherries in a slot machine. Here, Rabbit and his friend Future, played by Mekki Pfeiffer, improvise new lyrics about Rabbit's life to the song Sweet Home Alabama.
Yo, I gotta save up some money and get the hell out of here. Ridiculous.
Well, Jimmy moved in with his mother, 'cause he ain't got no place to go. And now I'm right back in the gutter with a garbage bag that's full of clothes.
Buzz it. 'Cause you live at home in a trailer. What the hell you gonna do?
Yeah! 'Cause I live at home in a trailer. Mom, I'm coming home to you.
Ever since the rock era began, movies starring pop idols have tended to be slack, lazy affairs designed to sell records or CDs. Not So 8 Mile, which is directed with great muscularity and verve by Curtis Hanson, best known for L.A. Confidential. Hanson has a feel for fading cities. His last film, Wonder Boys, vividly evoked the splendors of Pittsburgh. And here, his gritty handheld shooting style makes us feel the physical and psychological truth of Detroit's decline. Rabbit inhabits a landscape of trailers, gutted houses, liquor stores, cheap nightclubs, and once glorious old buildings now encrusted with failure. The only way out is through artistic self-creation. That's how Eminem did it, and he plays Rabbit with riveting intensity. No Madonna he. His exuberant music videos have already made it clear that Eminem's a flamboyantly expressive performer. And here, his eyes go from hooded to eerily wide, and each pang of emotion flickers across his features. He's not an actor of great range, and I don't exactly see him stealing roles from Tom Hanks. But as you'd expect of a guy who's pushed rap to new levels of personal revelation, he puts himself on the line. He transforms his anger and self-pity into funny, scabrous, incandescent language that takes an African-American style and gives it a distinctive spin. In the process, 8 Mile demonstrates that rap is as much about social class as it is about race. Rabbit never pretends to be black or denies his own background as so-called white trash. Indeed, that send-up of Sweet Home Alabama demonstrates just how close this rapper is to a kind of a redneck southern rock. Rather, he takes his underclass roots, poverty, terrible housing, the lack of a father, and uses them as his source of power and authenticity. I'd like to be able to tell you that this movie matches the playful subversiveness of Eminem's videos, but today's studio films take far fewer artistic chances than their mainstream music counterparts. Beneath its streetwise surface, 8 Mile lays on the old, earnest Hollywood hokum, giving us an idealized Eminem, a somewhat unreal Slim Shady, who's devoted to his little sister, defends the gay guy at work, and wins all his fistfights unless he's outnumbered. What saves us from becoming corny is the movie's keen sense of Rabbit's essential solitude as an artist, even when surrounded by friends. 8 Mile doesn't end on a Rocky-esque note of triumph, but with the awareness that to become fully himself, Rabbit must walk Detroit's mean streets alone, losing himself, as his new hit song has it, in the music and the moment.
John Powers writes the On column for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Look, if you had one shot, one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted, one moment that you captured, let it slip. Yo. His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater already. Mom's spaghetti, he's nervous, but on the surface he looks calm and ready.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002 books, titles, and characters in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. And DK Publishing, publisher of Bill Wyman's Rolling with the Stones, the inside story of the rock and roll band told by a man who can tell it like it was. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Molto Mario, we meet celebrity chef Mario Batali. He's the co-owner of three Manhattan restaurants and the host of a cooking show on the TV Food Network. Join us for the next Fresh Air.